Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Yo, 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 and welcome back. No, I won't do that. Hello. Hello. I was just trying to make it fresh. Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. Coming up on this week's episode of the podcast, we're going to be talking about microRNA and what goes on inside your cell. It's a fascinating conversation that blew my mind because what goes on inside every single one of your living cells is really mind-blowing. So you're going to enjoy that, I promise. Before that, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining us in studio is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland, which is the new body. And the IRC and Science Foundation Ireland had a baby, and that's Research Ireland, which is an amalgamation of the two groups. And Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD.
Yeah, we're still UCD.
Yeah, it's just, as always, UCD. Yeah. our first story, Ruth, has to do with dementia. And this is actually really positive for once, a story about dementia.
It is. It's a new report that's come out in The Lancet, and it's the third in a series of reports that is coming. It's a commission on dementia, and it's a global group of over 20 researchers led by a woman called Jill Livingston, who's in UCL. And what they've been doing is looking at the trends around dementia globally and what we can do about the growing burden of dementia. Now, the good news is the prevalence of dementia is actually going down in high-income countries, even though the numbers are going up because we're living for longer. But, you know, we're already intervening in some of the risk factors that make it more likely for us to get dementia. And that's really what this report is focusing on. So in the previous reports, there had been 12 different risk factors that had been looked at. This study has added two more. And they've done that by looking back over data from lots and lots of different studies, which look at correlations between different lifestyle and health factors and the likelihood of getting dementia, the onset of dementia, and how severe that dementia is.
And some of the stuff is quite, common sense, and some of the stuff isn't less so.
Is less so, exactly. I mean, the two new ones that they've added this time relate to your level of bad cholesterol, as it's called, or low density lipoprotein cholesterol. So keeping that low, particularly in midlife, is a good thing. It's one of the risk factors. And the other thing is vision loss. And again, one of the ones that they already knew about was hearing loss. So again, they're not saying that there's necessarily a causal link between the underlying factors for dementia and these. But if you think about, you know, your ability to hear, to engage in social activity, your ability to read and see what's going on, all of those things are going to contribute to your brain health. So there's kind of a general common sense approach here as well, but is now being underlined by research that's looking across all these many, many studies.
Yeah, and keeping the brain active seems to be key, and that's through all of the different senses, by giving it work to do, so engaging in work, or not just staring at the TV, but actually, yeah, you know, doing cognitive work, being able to see and hear and have conversations with people, being in the living world and having interaction seems to be really important to maintain brain health.
Absolutely. And it is also anima sano in corpore sano, because it's also having a healthy body for your brain to live in and exist in. So in fact, when they look at the interventions, they group them in terms of the stage of life where it's most important to focus on them. And in early life, it's education that's key. So your general level of education. And again, we hear about this all the time with things like early years education, that you reap a huge health dividend by getting in early with just overall good education for people when they are young. And actually, midlife is a really critical time for people to look after themselves. And it's a time they recognize here that many people have a lot of stress in their lives in midlife, you know, if they're parenting or caring, or may have a lot of job stress. So I think it's kind of a lesson to us all to step back and think about these things. I mean, I mentioned hearing loss and cholesterol. But things like depression, physical inactivity, diabetes, smoking, obesity, and excessive alcohol are some of the other factors that, if you can keep those under control in midlife, you're more likely to have a good outcome. And then when it comes to later life, it is that thing about social isolation. So reducing social isolation. Interestingly, air pollution, which I think we're going to hear more and more about in terms of our brain health, and vision loss. So trying to intervene early with vision loss. So this is about not going about struggling to see, not going about struggling to hear. do something about those things.
Sounds like
they're probably going to serve your brain well.
Social status is linked to all of those things.
Absolutely.
So I wonder how they don't know that it isn't just caused by the fact yeah. that you're poor or not.
Well, I think they're not claiming causality, but certainly these intervening on all of these could reduce the prevalence of dementia by 45%. And of course, many of these things are on the rise in, you know, the less developed countries in the world that have lower economic status. So we need to keep an eye on them there too.
Shane, our second story is a really interesting one because it is quite an impressive engineering feat. It's to do with drilling.
Yes. When you were a kid, were you ever told if you just dug a hole in the back garden, you'd reach China or Australia?
Is that impossible?
Yes.
Your drill might melt.
You're saying there's no chance at all?
Yes, there's no chance with current engineering, and I can't imagine, because the ground below us is not as solid as you think, right? So the crust is solid, the thin, hard bit on the edge of the Earth. But 80% of the Earth's mass its bulk is the mantle. And this study, published in Science, is about a story of drilling down to that mantle, right? We're scratching into it, but we're getting there 1.2 kilometres below an ocean trench. A big ship, an American ship, went out. It's been doing its thing for four decades. And just before its retirement, maybe as a going away gift, they drilled a core below the ocean floor into the crust and into the mantle. And I imagine this space to be more like a very slow moving fountain, right? I think it's very easy for us to think the ground is solid and so you're just drilling into hard rock. While it is hard, and but it's also viscous, it's flowing very gently. What they were able to do was tap into some of the rocks in the mantle. This is the deepest sample of rock we have ever extracted, and it looks like marble from Galway.
What?
Yeah, so have you ever seen Connemara marble is green?
Green,
right?
It's yeah.
beautiful, right? The museum building in Trinity has lots of it in the pillars. Lots of buildings around Ireland has it. Hmm. This looks that way, right? So it's a magnesium-rich mineral that comes up through magma, right? There's a lot of basalt.
Magma,
yeah. Basalt there too, which is an igneous type of rock, one of the three families of rock that we all remember from school.
Yeah.
Igneous, sedimentary, and metamorphic. Yeah, I had to look it up too. Yeah, my junior cycle.
You didn't give me long enough. I was just getting the word out.
It was there. It was on the tip of your tongue. Mm-hmm. But what happens is these things are kind of melting, and they, as the pressure drops, as they come closer to the earth, they actually melt, and then under the sea, they go through this process of interacting with seawater, a cool process called serpentinization. Right, which basically turns it into a glassy or marble-like substance. So they have these cores. They look like ice cores that people might be familiar with.
Yeah.
And this is the deepest we've ever dug. But just good timing. The research project is over. Right, the ship is to be decommissioned and the Americans haven't plans to build a new one. So we just about got into this new space, and scientists, geologists are very excited about going that little bit deeper through something called the basaltic layer, right into the mantle.
I mean, I'm not a geologist, as you're aware.
It rocks.
It sounds like Sue Kirk on Twitter said, this is the beginning of a horror movie. Is it not dangerous to be, you know, digging as deep as we can and, you know, creating holes in...
No. So it's
it's fine.
No, it's not.
That's okay.
No.
You don't need to give me any more detail. You can just say no. You've already ridiculed me twice.
No,
let's
but
move on.
I did love in this study that there didn't seem to be any direct, as far as I could see, there didn't seem like, and the applications of this work are blah. It was like they were just doing it because they wanted to do it. And I know it's expensive or whatever, but this is kind of Science 101. I loved it. Brilliant story. Published in Science. Everyone should read it.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Shane, for that endorsement. Our third story, Ruth, has to do with aging. And I really like this story because it's actually, it's quite counterintuitive, because we tend to think of aging as being something that happens steadily throughout our lives.
Yeah, well, I wonder, is it? Yeah, this is work from Stanford that was published in Nature Aging. But if you think about the life course and you think about how much you change from the age zero to the age one, and then from age one to age five, I mean, clearly you change a huge amount more than maybe you do between 20 and 25. So I think we actually intuitively know that we don't age in a linear fashion. But I think maybe we think once we're an adult, it's sort of a slow and steady process. And this study really challenges that. So what they did was they had 108 volunteers, and they submitted a huge number of samples every few months between 1 and 7 years. And they were obviously all different ages. So they submitted blood samples, stool samples, and swabs from all over their body. And the researchers looked at 135,000 different molecules from their body. So RNA, proteins, different metabolites,
wow.
and all of the microbes that were living on all different parts of their bodies. And what they found was, when they looked at all of those molecules, most of them stayed the same, and they did, but they didn't shift in this gradual way. They found sudden changes at two different life points. One was in the mid 40s, around age 44, and the other was in the early 60s. And it was that was kind of interesting. The mid 40s one, particularly, they were looking at women initially because they were thinking, was that associated with perimenopause or menopause? But actually, they found similar shifts in the men as well. So again, it's obviously something else going on there. And they found the changes. And again, people might not be so surprised here. They found the changes were in molecules linked to things like cardiovascular disease, but also the ability to metabolize caffeine, alcohol, and certain fats. So again, I think a lot of people might associate with that if they've been through their mid-40s. You know, I could have a glass of wine before, I can't anymore. Mm. So they did actually find changes that resonated with that experience that people have. And then the second wave of changes that they found in the early 60s were related to molecules involved in the immune function, carbohydrate metabolism, and kidney function. And they found actually molecules related to skin and muscle aging changed at both time points quite suddenly.
Yeah.
So it is interesting. They had other research that suggests there could be another spike pending in the late 70s, kind of 78, but they didn't have anyone in that age
bracket. No one's old enough yet to be able to check that.
Yeah. So
we kind of, from adulthood to 40-something.
44,
it's, 44, it's kind of, you know, and then there's a quick burst of rapid changing associated with aging.
No, I'm 44. This is disastrous.
It's okay. Look at me. I'm 48. I look fantastic.
Yeah. Listeners, yeah.
And then 60 again. It sort of ramps up again. And then presumably
and then
goes
stops.
Off again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So and again, I think people will actually resonate with some of this because this is you hear some of this in kind of popular culture that these milestones are in people's lives. But of course, they relate to things going on as well. But certainly interesting work. It wasn't a huge sample, and when you parse it out at all the different age ranges and men and women, they don't have a huge number.
Good.
So I'm sure. Yeah, exactly.
I'm all right.
You're all right, Shane, maybe.
Our final story has to do with some put-out scientists and astronomers.
Yeah, space science always gets a ridiculous budget, right? Like, it really does compared to most other forms of science.
Because it's space.
It is. And
expensive.
It is expensive. And so this is about a story that has already cost $450 million. And I'm sure Research Ireland could do a lot with $450 million. But this is only one of NASA's many projects. But they've decided to put this one on hold. And it is the Viper moon rover. As I say, they've already spent $450 million building the thing. And they're meant to send it next year to the moon, and they've decided not to send it. And thousands of scientists, probably a lot of them working on this, are understandably annoyed, and they have asked the US Congress to get involved and to try and put some pressure on NASA to reverse their decision.
It's a cool mission, though.
It is, yeah. So, like, what it's trying to do is go to the moon and drill and look and see where, if there is water in the lunar soil. So it's thought that all water on the Earth may have come from comets from outer space. If that's true, there should be water in other places like the moon. And if there is water on the moon and we can access it, then it's useful as a fuel source for any mission that might leave the moon, say, to go to Mars, because you can split water, H2O, into oxygen and hydrogen, and both of those are rocket fuel. And you can also drink it, strangely enough. So they've decided to cut the program, and the scientists are going crazy, and they're saying, well, if you cut this one, a lot of subsequent programs might be in jeopardy, because how can we plan future missions that might leave the moon if we don't know whether there's water there to make fuel? But I don't know, as I read it, I just thought $450 million is a lot of money, and like, I don't know what you guys think.
Is this?
Yeah, it is. I'm just wondering at this stage, I am sort of conflicted. Should we invest in these things because they're cool? And I just said the last story was cool. Or at this stage, should a lot of our research focus be on trying to save the Earth? And I'm being serious about that, like, as in, what can we do to adapt and transform for a climate and ecological emergency? If all scientists are not working on this in some way, shape or kind at the moment, should they be?
Hmm. Nice way to end the piece, Shane. A real downer, as usual. Bloody hell. Why do we bother? Like, this is nothing to do with climate change. This is a space story.
Everything has got something to do with climate
change. It's true. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland, thank you both for joining me. Now, we all know the terms DNA and genes, and we might loosely know that we are a product of our genes, and those genes contain DNA, which is the code from which we're created. But there's so much more to how life becomes life, and recently we've started to hear a little bit more about RNA and so-called mRNA. So what are these other elements to our genetic makeup and what do they do? Well, David Henshaw is a professor of physiology and medical physics at RCSI. He's the author of Fine-Tuning Life, a guide to microRNAs, your genome's master regulators. Welcome to the programme, David. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Let's start off with a biology lesson. So DNA, as everybody knows, is a tightly coiled strand that's in each of our cells and has a blueprint for life. And that DNA is made up of little bits called genes, which are in bigger bits called chromosomes. Am I right so far?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Fantastic. These genes make proteins and those proteins make us. And that's the bit we want to talk about, how that happens, if that's okay. So inside each cell, we have these genes and they're parts of the DNA. What is a protein and how do genes make proteins and how do proteins make this stuff?
Absolutely. So
that's the only question I'm going to ask you in 50 minutes.
So as you say, a gene is really a stretch or a piece of DNA that contains the instructions to build a protein. So proteins are really what cells use to do all the different jobs they have to do. And they're incredibly versatile and diverse. So taking an example, hemoglobin, this is what's packed inside our red blood cells, and it carries oxygen around the body. Up in the brain, we have proteins that can produce neurotransmitters, which are the signals that we use to communicate between brain cells. So,
and these proteins are essentially just floating chemicals, sort of bunches of floating chemicals?
So proteins are made up of amino acids. They are a sequence of amino acids. We have about 20 different amino acids. And the different proteins that we have are really combinations of those 20 different amino acids. So if you want to build a sort of protein that's a bit more structural, a bit like scaffolding for a cell, you put one set of amino acids together. If you want it to be an enzyme to make neurotransmitters,
they're like Lego bricks, and you can make a plane or you can make a building.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
So our gene is really the DNA instructions to build that protein. But there's a step in between. We don't just jump from DNA to protein, and that step in between is an information containing molecule called RNA.
Okay. So, why would DNA make a protein at all? Or why would our cells make a protein? What kicks off that process? Something in the environment around the cell, I presume.
Yeah, absolutely. So all of the cells in the body have the same set of instructions, about 20,000 genes. But obviously, some proteins are needed in some cells and some in others. So,
just a quick clarification on that. In our cell, are there in each individual cell, is there just one complete set of DNA?
Yes.
Right, okay, so there's only one complete set in... Okay, perfect.
But that set has all the information to make 20,000... all 20,000 genes are there.
Right.
But they're not all switched on at once. So some are switched on and some are switched off. So a brain cell will have a particular set of genes that are switched on. A blood cell would have a different set of genes.
Right, and so that's why some cells make different proteins and some, therefore, those proteins means that those cells have, inverted commas, different functions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Okay.
And so signals either from within the cell or from outside of the cell, they trigger the genes to switch on or switch off.
Okay. And so the RNA is in between the DNA, the gene in the DNA and the protein. What is happening there? When there's some sort of signal to the cell to make a particular protein, say, for example, there's some sort of inflammation and the cell is told it needs to generate some sort of immune response, for example. What is happening to the DNA? And from there, how does it end up making a protein that may produce anti-inflammatory response?
Yeah, so the first step is that the DNA double helix unzips, so a bit like undoing a zipper. And then the RNA is made as a copy, a sort of a mirror image of one of those strands of DNA. So that one strand of DNA that's been separated from the other, the RNA is a kind of copy of that information. The RNA then leaves the DNA behind. The DNA sits in the nucleus of our cells. The RNA starts to head out on its journey.
And this is an unusual process, right? So the DNA sort of zips apart and leaves, sort of like teeth of a zipper, And the RNA is made up of bits of DNA that's floating around in the cell, sort of free pieces of DNA that end up sort of self-assembling. These are the four bases. Is that right? They're sort of floating around in the, they're not quite DNA yet. They're just floating around in the cell, and they are sort of magnetically attached to the zipper, creating this copy. Is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of getting close to it. So there are four of these different chemical bases in DNA. They go by the letters A, C, G, and T. And this sort of zippering together, so an A will always pair to a T and a C to a G. So DNA is really just this really long string of A, C, G, G, C, T, T, C, etc.
Yeah.
Each gene has its own particular combination. Now, when that DNA separates and we start to form our RNA, our signal carrier, then if an A is red, it puts a particular base across from it. If a C is red, it'll put a G, a C. RNA is slightly different to DNA. So while DNA has a base called T, RNA, it's actually a U. But basically, very similar things. These bases basically mirror each other. So you get a copy, a kind of carbon copy of your gene into your RNA. And then that takes the signal out of the cell towards the protein production factory.
Right. So it's like, almost like someone going into the library, reading the page, getting the information, and then leaving.
Yeah.
Okay, absolutely. Great. And so then this piece of RNA, which is kind of like a floaty bit of DNA, mm-hmm. leaves the DNA. The DNA presumably zips back up.
Yep.
So cool, isn't it? When you think about it, it's insane that this happens in every cell in our body. Absolutely insane. So the DNA zips back up because it has done its job of synthesizing this RNA. So now this RNA piece is floating about, and it does what?
So the RNA, the mRNA, the messenger RNA now heads to something called a ribosome. This is often described as the protein production factory. And then it gets threaded into the ribosome, a bit like a shoelace going through a boot.
Right.
And as it threads through the ribosome, amino acids are assembled one after the other based on the information in that mRNA. So if it reads a particular sequence of bases, say A, C, G, it'll pick one amino acid. If it reads C, G, U, it picks a different amino acid.
Right. And so to get to the ribosome, it isn't like there's no conscious directing, right? It's presumably it just floats around and through just moving around, or is it a drawn from through chemicals or some other reason to the ribosome? How does it get there?
So it's chaperoned the whole way. There are proteins that basically lock onto RNA and they move it in the direction that it should be going.
This is so insane. Okay, so then it goes to the sort of the factory, and this ribosome takes the instructions. And how does it make the proteins from the instructions of the RNA? Does it do that from material from the environment, or is it a storage facility already of the building blocks of the proteins?
That's exactly it, actually. So within the ribosome, the amino acids are sitting there. You know, you've got your sort of full set of 20 different amino acids sitting there, and they are actually themselves stuck onto another type of RNA. That's called a tRNA. And that basically brings the amino acid to the mRNA, and they all start to join together. And a protein is really just this long string of amino acids.
And so then what happens? So then, I mean, that is so insane as a process. Then these amino acids then combine, like Optimus Prime and the rest of the Transformers, to create a giant amino acid-based structure, which is our protein. And that protein could be, as we say, any sort of a different protein, depending on what amino acids you put together.
Yeah.
And what time is it now? That was 8 minutes. That's pretty good, isn't it? So how do we use this for the benefit of medicine? So we have an understanding of this. It sounds like, the way you've described it, it sounds like we have a really good understanding of the mechanism for doing this. Presumably this is, over 100 years worth of research, but more fine-tuned in the last 20 years or so, 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, discoveries come thick and fast in science. While we have a really good understanding of the general gene pathway, we're still discovering things all the time. So it's a moving target. But yeah, we have the core understanding of the pathway. And actually, one of the things that's interesting is that the gene pathway itself is actually not quite as great as we would like to explain. And what I mean by that is, there's a certain amount of noise and randomness that is in the system. Mm. And this is where microRNAs come in. So in order for the gene pathway to work smoothly...
When you say the gene pathway, what do you mean by that?
Gene pathway means from DNA to protein.
Okay.
So the steps that we just went through from sort of start to finish, that's what we kind of talk about as the gene pathway. But it doesn't run as smoothly as we like to think. And actually, there's other elements buried in our genomes, buried amongst the DNA, that help to make it work smoothly.
And that's what we're trying to figure out, because the sort of dirt in the system, which you would imagine, because it's quite a noisy environment, the inside of a cell, and that you know, that it's incredible how well this system works. And what we're trying to understand, I suppose, is how and why it works so well. And if we think a little bit about gene therapies, how do they work, and what sort of part of that process that we've just talked about do they use to create a response in a gene of a patient?
Yeah, so gene therapies are generally split into one of two types. Either you're talking about trying to fix the DNA itself. Maybe somebody has a mutation in a particular gene, and what you'd really like to do is go in and correct that mutation, or maybe remove the old gene and stick a new one in. So there's that sort of DNA level gene therapy. But gene therapy also includes things if you're interfering with RNA at some stage. And depending on the condition, you may want to do one or the other. Certainly at the moment, in terms of what we're using in patients, the majority of gene therapies are more towards RNA and kind of temporary gene therapy. So you can design drug-like molecules to RNAs that will work, but for a short period of time, perhaps, and then they'll kind of start to wear off again.
Right.
Gene therapy, when we're changing DNA, is a really permanent thing, an all or none thing, and the risks are higher.
Right. When we talk about RNA, that messenger part that goes to the ribosome, that's not the same as microRNA. What's the difference, and why are microRNAs so important?
So, as the messenger RNA is getting moved towards the ribosome, this is where microRNAs act. And they're like our kind of regulators of our genome. So microRNAs are also genes, but they don't code for protein. So when the microRNA gene, when the DNA gets read, it produces an RNA. And then the RNA also moves out of the nucleus, starts heading towards the ribosome. As it goes along, it gets sort of cut into smaller and smaller pieces. And then just before...
And what does that process?
So there's a whole other sort of pathway of enzymes that sort of look after the microRNA. They sort of start to cut it down to size. And then it ends up being quite a short molecule, much, much shorter than the mRNA.
Right.
And so just around where the mRNA is getting threaded into the ribosome, microRNAs stick onto them. And a microRNA recognizes information bases in the messenger RNA and it locks onto it, a bit like kind of Velcro, molecular Velcro.
And what is the function of microRNA?
So what we've now done is we've sort of created a knot in the shoelace. The messenger RNA now can't get threaded through the ribosome. It can't build a protein. So really what microRNAs do is lower or stop the production of certain proteins.
Right, so microRNAs aren't necessarily a problematic subcell particle?
No, not at all. They're actually essential for life. In fact, if we, and people have done this experimentally, if you prevent microRNAs from being produced, if you block them from being produced in the first place, then gene activity quickly goes haywire. And in fact, this of course leads on to obvious human health conditions such as cancers and neurodegeneration, where we know that there are changes to microRNAs.
All right, so If you let that DNA to protein process run willy-nilly, it goes gangbusters and you have problematic cancer and other types where you have far too much genetic activity.
Exactly.
And so microRNA is a way of sort of stopping that. It doesn't seem to make sense. Why have we evolved that process of making these bulky RNA fragments only to snip them with enzymes and then clog them with microRNAs?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So what we've learned is that the normal gene pathway system overproduces or is a little bit overactive, and feedback systems, sort of what we call negative feedback, stabilizes all of this. It produces sharper gene activity levels within a cell. And in particular, as cells are dividing, microRNAs are really great because they can switch off genes that used to be on and kind of create a sharper separation as cells divide and begin to change into their final forms.
Okay, so, I mean, we've talked about how we might use DNA and RNA in medicine, but what about these microRNAs? I mean, being able to regulate the production of protein seems to me to be a very valuable thing in medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the point that I got interested in microRNAs, because we were sort of dealing with a big challenge in the disease that we work on, which is epilepsy. So in epilepsy, what we found is that there are really large numbers of genes which are altered. So there probably isn't a sort of a magic, easy to fix gene that will solve the problem.
Right. You can't go around and snip at a whole bunch of genes and hope everything's going to go away. The risk is too high and side effects could be likely. It sounds very, very complex.
Exactly. We were looking for a sort of a master controller. And so one of the features of microRNAs is that an individual micron, a single microRNA, will actually stick onto dozens of other messenger RNAs. So it sort of controls a whole group of genes, if you like a sort of shepherd herding and looking after a group of sheep. And so we thought, well, maybe there's a microRNA out there that controls the set of genes that are, if you like, slightly wrong in epilepsy. And so by going after one microRNA, we could actually produce small amounts of changes to lots and lots of genes at the same time. And that seems to be the case.
Okay, wow. So how that leads itself to some molecular therapies and some targets for therapy we're talking about persistent epilepsy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what does that look like?
So you can actually design a molecule, a drug-like molecule that will lock onto the microRNA itself. And you can design it very, very specifically so it'll only stick to that microRNA and no others. So we've been looking for a long time for the sort of the microRNA for epilepsy. And we've identified one that we think of. So there's, and I should say this, there's about 2,000 different microRNAs in the human genome. So we've sort of found one that we think is the one that has the best chance of changing the genes that are altered in epilepsy.
And so you want to be able to regulate the activity of this microRNA, either slow it down or speed it up or whatever that tampering is required to reduce the epileptic fits and the symptoms of that disease.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can actually design a molecule that will basically stop this particular microRNA. In this case, the microRNA we're going after seems to be more abundant. There seems to be more of it in brain cells than there should be. And so what we're trying to do is actually dampen down the microRNA level.
Right. Is this approach something that could be used in treating other diseases?
Yes, there's actually a number of microRNAs that have been linked to other brain diseases, as well as other conditions, things like cancers. So it's possible that in some diseases you might want to put the microRNA back into cells. In other cells, you might want to remove it or prevent it from working.
And David, very briefly, we've been talking about mRNA all throughout the program. I'm sure someone says, why haven't you mentioned COVID? This has nothing to do with COVID, which is perhaps confusing for people, but that's not microRNA at all.
Correct. The thing we're talking about with COVID, the mRNA vaccine. So essentially what they did was they got the sequence to make this spike protein, the mRNA sequence for the spike protein, and they sort of introduce it to the immune system. The immune system then learns what to look for and to knock it out, but it's not a microRNA.
Okay. David Henshall is the author of Fine-Tuning Life, A Guide to MicroRNAs, Your Genome's Master Regulators. David, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was amazing. What I promised you it would be interesting. It was interesting, was it not, producer Aidan McKelvey, who's joined us in the studio?
Yeah, it's incredible what goes on in our cells. And there's a great video, we'll put it up on Twitter, of a kinesin protein, I think it is, dragging something across the cell, like like David was saying, the proteins take the RNA across the cell. This is Dragon Cross, and it looks like a cartoon character. It's like walking along.
I think I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah. We'll put it up on Twitter. You should have a look at it. It's just amazing to think what's going on down there.
Absolutely crazy. Right, we are going to look through some of your comments from last week's episode, and we were talking about the Wooden Age, which is the lost era, really, because we talk about the Bronze Age and the Stone Age and so on. But of course, wood deteriorates, and so there's not much evidence of it. So we were talking about the Wooden Age last week. Someone says, it's a nonsense to say that they can date something to a million or millions of years. Carbon-14 is not reliable at that length of time. Thanks, Kevin. Is it not?
It isn't, but there are other similar,
techniques.
Well, there are other atoms that degrade slower, like
yeah,
uranium and plutonium. So they're less accurate, but they can be used for the bigger distances, or the bigger, they can be used for the longer ages because, what's the word I'm looking for? They can be used for further back in time because you don't need to be accurate to say 1,000 years or 100 years because we're talking about millions of years.
Yeah.
But yeah, carbon 14, I think, is only 50,000 years, 60,000 years accuracy. So generally, paleontologists will use carbon 14 and geologists will use some other.
I see. Okay, very interesting. Did you Google that? Or did you just know it? You did Google it, yeah. Okay, that's fine. No, it's good. Just be honest. Just be honest with the audience is all I'm going to ask.
My moment.
There are perfectly preserved 7 million-year-old trees found in a lignite mine in Hungary on show in the city of Miskolc. If I'm ever in Miskolc, I will definitely check out the 7 million-year-old trees.
I'm really disappointed. I'm just back from Budapest.
Yeah, dear.
Texter could have texted me last week.
And is Miskolc near?
I don't know, actually.
Yeah. Google that. We were also talking about Christ, were we?
No, we weren't.
Oh, well, someone takes in about Christ anyway, and they said the French rejected Christ. He is the supreme authority. I was disappointed that people are calling it diversity. What the hell is this about? Same as the soldiers who crucified Christ out of ignorance. We need to pray for the salvation of souls, as people really are like sheep and follow the crowd. That's from Marion Walkenstein. Good stuff. Thanks very much for that, Ray. Do with that what you will. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed next week. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.